Redacted Media and GhostHat.net present The Film Illogical Society. On today's episode, we continue our countdown of the BBC's 100 Greatest Comedies of All Time. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Scholes and Chad Halverson.
And welcome back again to the Film Illogical Society, the countdown show. This is your host, Chris Scholes, and with me is the other host.
Oh, you want me to? I thought you were going to say my name.
Yeah, I did a nice introduction.
You're handing the proverbial ball over to me, and I dropped it, as it were. Okay.
Right. Yeah, you just kind of watched it as it fell, hit your lap.
That sums up all of my school sport performances to like a T. So thank you. You wanna set me up again?
Yeah.
All right, I'm ready. I got the bat up.
I am your host, Chris Scholes, and with me is another host.
My name is Chad Halverson.
All right, Larry. So here in this show, this is the list show, so we are doing the top 100 comedies of all time as determined by the BBC.
Ever.
This is the list. Like, you cannot argue with this list because it's the BBC. They speak to you with a British accent.
Yeah, so they sound really like smart. They know what they're talking about.
Yeah, so they are right. And at number 86, because we are in 86 already, is Kind Hearts and Coronets, directed by Robert Hammer. It's a 1949 film. The most notable star is Alec Guinness, and we will talk about him a lot because he is in this movie a lot. So he may not be the main actor, the main character, but he has probably the most screen time. So, Chad, would you like to just give a brief synopsis of what this movie
sure.
is about?
So it starts out with Louis Mazzini, well, Louis Descone Mazzini. He's in a prison cell. It sounds like he's going to be hung the next day for murder.
They was right.
Thanks for bearing the lead. So he, in the beginning, he's writing his memoirs because nobody believes him, so he's just going to write down everything. And he just starts from the beginning. So when he was born, his mother was from this affluent family, the Descone. Am I saying it right? Descone?
Okay.
Yeah. So this rich-ass family became dukes, like, a billion years ago because England has that shit. And, yeah.
They're aristocrats.
Louis's mother, instead of marrying somebody that the family approved of, she ran away with an Italian singer. They end up conceiving a child. The father dies when the child's born, and the mother is now left to raise this kid, not only by herself, but when she married this guy, her family disowned her. Like, you know, you don't get anything anymore. So Louis grows up with his mom taking care of him. She had to get a commoner job, and, you know, she was hoping that once he got older, he could go back into the family and claim his birthright. Well, she writes to one of her kin, and they say, no, like, we don't know who you are, you cray-cray, like, we want nothing to do with you. And she ends up getting severely injured, and on her deathbed, she told her son Louis, like, hey, you know, I want to be married at the castle. I want to be married, you know, with my kin, and it's my birthright. So Louis sends a letter to the Duke, and the Duke says no. So from that point on, Louis makes it his personal mission to not only take out every single family member that's in line for this Duke title, but, you know, to also claim it for himself.
So seven. So
yeah, seven people are ahead of him. So and like Louis up to this point, besides meeting him in the beginning, like he seems like a normal person, and you know, once his mom's gone, like he, you know, he has to settle for a commoner job. He has to move in with his friend's parents. He totally crushes on her, but because he's, you know, doesn't have money, she, you know, she's his friend, but also she's quote unquote realistic and, you know, has to find a man with money because this was 1949 or whatever.
Right. I mean, some things still hold true. Go ahead.
So he ends up coming up with this elaborate scheme that at first starts not innocently, but it started pretty easily. Like one of the sons, young Ascone, comes into his store, gives him some lip. He finds out who he is. He's like, "Oh, you're next on my list. Like you are number one on my list, motherfucker." He goes out and he stalks this this couple at a weekend retreat, and they're necking, as my wife would call it, on a boat during a high tide in a waterfall, and Louis just kind of like lets the moor go, and there he goes. And the whole narrative is a mix between, you know, live action and then Louis kind of like recanting the story, so it's a lot of narration. I also, quick side note, I had to turn on subtitles for this because their English was not that I couldn't understand it, but it was older English, like a lot of it. It was aristocratic English. And there was a couple words like off the bat. I'm like, all right, closed captioning, here we go.
Yeah, I mean, I know if it was Cockney, we'd be like, oh yeah, I got this. This is no problem. Mm. But highbrow, it's too fancy for me. I understand the challenge.
So then this starts a chain of events of him just knocking off all these family members. One family member is married to this woman that eventually Louis... let me back up. So Louis offered to marry this girl, the girl of his dreams, who I don't really like. I think she's a bitch. But her name is Sibella. And he's like, hey, you should marry me because we're friends and we're compatible. She's like, you don't have money. I'm not going to marry you. And he's like, well, if I become a duke, will you marry me? And she just kind of laughs it off. And she gets engaged to this guy named Lionel. No, not Thundercats Lionel, but close. And as soon as that happens, he gets a job working for one of his... It was his uncle, right, that had the bank. And he ends up, like... He gets in, and like the family knows that he's sort of a family member, but they're not treating him like one. But he's slowly working his way through. Like he just needs to get close to all these different people so he can take them out. One of the kin is a photographer, so he ends up going into his lab where he develops all his photos, and he secretly has a drinking problem, so he switches the alcohol with like photography liquid, and ends up causing an explosion or a chemical reaction, so he dies. One of the female kin is an activist for women's suffrage. Yeah,
suffrage.
And she goes up in this hot air balloon, and he just takes Louis just takes an arrow, and you don't see it, but it's implied that he shoots an arrow, the balloon goes down, and she dies from that. So slowly he's picking everybody off until he gets to the point where the Duke, like the actual Duke, is next. But the Duke like never leaves his castle. He's hard to get to. So he ends up he ends up having an engagement with Edith. Who is the widow?
The widow of the young.
Was that young Henry? Yeah.
The photographer. That was Henry.
There's so many fucking people.
I think you're right.
All played by one person. So that sets up a chain of events where, okay, now the Duke wants to meet Louis, see if he's on the up and up. And Louis, I forgot, what was the... There was a titular point where he was just going there to kind of scope it up, but then he knew he had to kill him because of a certain thing that happened, and I lost that moment.
Yeah, I think because the Duke basically said he'll never get those seats.
So Louis's like, well, fuck that guy. I'm going to kill him this weekend. So they go out hunting. Louis comes up with a way, because there's all these man traps, as they call them. Really, they're just giant bear traps because they're aristocrats and they have a bajillion acres, and they catch poachers in these traps. And Louis finds that inhumane. That's the cool thing about Louis as a character. He's not... like, he's a bad person for being a killer, but he's likable in sort of a Dexter sort of way. Like, because...
Are you saying you can identify with him? With a serial killer?
Sure. Wouldn't be the first time. Yeah.
Serial family killer. I mean, it's different than other serial killers. Yes,
keep it in the family.
Yes.
Louis... ends up tricking the Duke to get in one of these traps, and he takes his gun, and at this point, like, Louis hasn't, like, really stabbed or, like, everything was, like, it was his hand doing it, but it was, like, a third-party hand. Like, he wasn't actively doing...
It could be explained elsewhere. The priest elsewhere. That he killed. You know, a fire started. Yeah, the priest started, the waterfall, the balloon... fell.
This was the only point where, like, he had a gun, and he told the Duke essentially to shut up. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you, and then I'm going to kill you. And that's exactly what he does. He tells his whole life story, the abridged version, you know, hey, you kicked me and my mom out of this family, and now I'm getting my birthright, and I've killed everybody up to this point. And he's like, you know, I could just say that you got into this trap, you dropped your gun, and it shot you in the face, and that's what I'm going to do. And that's exactly what he does.
So like in a flashback, because most of this movie is a flashback, he gives the Duke a flashback.
Flash Inception back.
It's a meta flashback.
So and then after the Duke dies, and then the banker also dies because he hears that his brother has died, and he just dies. So now everybody's dead.
Yeah,
Louis is the successor. He, you know, just announces, like, "Hey, we're gonna do it, and we're awesome, and blah blah blah." And then all of a sudden, a cop from Scotland Yard's like, "You're under arrest for murder." And at this point, you're like, "Oh shit, which one?" And I left out a key point here. So the side story with Sabella, her and Louis have a thing like the whole time she's engaged and married. Like, she's always coming over and quote-unquote making out. They never show anything more than that, because it was 1949, and people didn't have sex. Okay?
Right.
Sabella came over and tried to blackmail Louis after he had just visited her husband, Lionel, who had just confessed that, like, he lost all his money. Like, I have nothing left, and I need your help. And Louis's like, no, we were never friends. You're an asshole. I'm getting out of here. And Lionel gets mad, and he tries to kill Louis. And Louis just kind of... and Louis throws him down. He's like, I'm not going to fight with a drunk man. And, you know, Lionel says he's going to kill himself. And he's like, well, that would be stupid. So he leaves, and Lionel ended up dying. And they said Louis did it because he was the last one to see Lionel. So we get to... present day. Well, before we get to present day, there's one more flashback where Louis gets visited by Sabella. She's like, look, I can make this all go away. There could be, wink, a suicide note that he left that I could find before you're hung tomorrow, but you have to choose me over your new wife, Edith, and you have to kill her. So... he's like, all right, yeah, you know, what else? What other choice do I have? Right at the 11th hour, they're about to, you know, bring him out to hang him. And all of a sudden, the president just called, and you got a pardon. That moment happens. And this, all right, this is the best part of the movie.
The Prime Minister.
And I'll get to this later, but I like this movie. But the ending was the best, because at the end, he's left with a choice. His new wife, Edith, is there, the one that's, you know, part of this Descone family, and, you know, they can sit and be the Duke and Duchess of whatever the fuck. And then in the other carriage is Sabella, who he had always liked, And in a sense, he says he likes her more, but only when he's with Edith, which is really weird. And for a moment, you're like, oh, shit, who's he going to choose? Like, you know, Sabella totally came up with a suicide note, but, you know, he should be right by Edith. And then all of a sudden, a newspaper reporter comes up like, hey, you know, Louis, could we write or publish your memoirs? And he's like, my memoirs. And then that, like, moment of clarity happens where he's like, oh, shit, I left my memoirs in the cell that I just left. And, you know, insinuating that somebody's going to find him and know the whole story, that he killed everybody but Lionel. And that's the end.
So, yeah, so it leaves it pretty open because you don't know what's
going to happen. But the best part of that ending is, like, it completely diverts, like, what you were thinking about, because you were like, oh shit, is he gonna take Sabella? Is he gonna take Edith? Sabella, Edith, like, what's he gonna do? I must know. And then they kind of, it's a very T.C. DeWitt style of hitting you back in the face in the end. Not that I'm giving T.C. DeWitt credit for this, like, he didn't come up with this idea, but you know what I'm saying, like, where the stuff that we make sometimes, like, we'll bury that very deep in layered. Like, that joke is set up from the beginning. When you first meet the character, he is writing those memoirs.
Because he's writing.
And then that's all you ever hear of it. The entire movie is then those flashbacks in those memoirs. And the fact that that joke comes all the way back at the end to take you out of the moment of what you thought mattered, I thought was brilliant. Like, I really love the ending. I thought that was super smart, and it was a good idea.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was a well-written film. I agree with the subtitles because it is a highbrow English accent. Like, it's a very aristocratic accent. And yeah, it's not the London accent that I believe most of us are used to. I think it was London accent.
There were words I had to look up. Like, oh, I've never heard of that before.
There were... Yep, because this was not only a film from 1949, but it was also taking place in the past. So they used words that weren't even common in 1949 Britain, but were common in 1800s Britain. So, for instance, this film, one of the lines is, "Revenge is a dish which people of taste prefer to eat cold."
Yeah, they stole that from
Which
Star Trek.
Which we would say a revenge is a
they
dish.
They stole that from Star Trek
cold,
30 years before.
Right? So let's talk a little bit about Alec Guinness. Now, like I said before, most of us know him as Obi-Wan Kenobi. Mm-hmm. Well, I was waiting for you to jump in there, but that's okay. So he played 9 roles in this film. He played, and he was 35 when this film was done, which tells you, you know, a little bit of how old he was in 1977 when Silas
As if the gray beard he but, had the whole movie didn't give it away, Chris.
Hey, makeup, okay? so he plays, let me
I
just
gotta
look this
hear,
up
I
so I get it right. He plays the Etherid, the 8th Duke of Chalfont, Reverend Lord Henry, General Lord Rufus, Admiral Lord Horatio, who, by the way, dies when his ship is run into by another ship, and he's the only one because he...
Yeah, he goes down with the ship, so he's the only one that dies.
He goes down with the ship. Then he's Lord Ascoigne, young Ascoigne, young Henry, and Lady Agatha Descoigne. And he also plays the 7th Duke in a brief flashback sequence. So he plays 9 characters in this film. They originally were going to give him 4, but after he read the script, he says, why can't I play all 8? And then they added a 9th.
At that point, too, like, why would you, if you're going to have Alec Guinness already play 4 characters, like, why doesn't he just play all of them at that point? Like, why would you split it up?
Well, and I wonder, too, like, how common this was in films at the time.
Maybe not so much in films, but it's definitely a stage thing.
It is. But this one, I mean, being... So I know that, you know, a lot of the films that we've seen of this same era, they've felt like... And they very much were adaptations of stage plays. This one did not. This one felt very much like a film. And there's one scene in particular that I want to talk about. Okay, so let's kind of recreate this, because this is filming in 1949. So so producer and editor Chad, I'm talking to you right now. All right, so I'm the director, and this is what I want to do. I want to have the same actor play 8 roles and have them be in the same shot. How would you do it
green
today?
Screen.
Green screen. How would you do that? Like, can you explain it a little bit?
Well, you could shoot it as plates, too, so...
Well, let's get to the green screen, the most probably the one that most
so the specific shot you're talking about is one of the funerals. All the surviving up to that point members of the Descone family are all sitting in these you know big seats in this church. It's the family church, and it's Alec Guinness as all those characters, but it's in a wide shot. So if you're doing that today, you'd have the space created digitally, or you would shoot a plate and then you would recreate that space with a giant green psych behind Alec Guinness, and he would essentially just sit in all, I think it was like 5 or 6 seats. Yeah, 6 seats.
6 seats.
You'd shoot those, and it was only a static shot, so all you got to do is just shoot it straight on. And then in post-production, you take all those assets, you get the green out, and you stack everything on top of your plate, and there's your shot.
So how long do you think that would take to shoot? And let's say it's a couple minutes that you have that shot, right? So it's not a long shot. How long would you say for shooting that scene it would take?
Not counting setup and all that stuff, I probably like an hour. It wasn't that big of a shot, so and not accounting for different makeup jobs and costume changes.
Costume change. So maybe half a day. Okay, so this shot, this was a very complicated shot. This took 2 days to film because they didn't have green screen back then. They didn't have special effects. So they had to do all of this practically. So they some things were the same, right? They set up the camera. The camera did not move. They had people that guarded the camera overnight.
That was critical. Yeah,
it took 2 days to shoot. Because it could not, if it moved just a little bit, the shot was ruined. And they basically just blocked out everything in the camera except for the one seat that they were filming. And then they used the same film over and over again. So they re-exposed it over and over again
that
to get all
sense.
6
There's,
of them in
I
there.
I can't think of an example because I'm a bad film historian, but I know that's been done before, but that's hard because not only the way film used to work is, or in film still works, we just don't use it anymore, but light exposes your film by it passing through a gate at a certain amount of time and the shutter opening for a certain amount of time. If you open it too much or not enough, like, it's ruined. So not only did they have, like, they had to always, like, the lighting had to match, and then they would have to take that film reel, rewind it, and re-thread it without exposing that to sunlight. Because when you had a film, at least back when I was in school, you had to learn how to change your films or add film stock under a blanket or in the dark, because any random sunlight to that would ruin the entire thing. So I'm surprised it only took them 2 days to do that.
According to the research, because I wasn't there actually, but according to the research, most of that was the costume changing
That's I mean
for Alec Guinness.
Man, that's and I was curious on what the special effects were in the front end credits because they said special effects team, you know, it was two people. I was like, wow, all right. Special yeah. effects, huh?
Yeah, not like right, you go to any like Marvel film now and the special effects
three quarters
the end credits
of
takes
the
at
whole
least 10 minutes.
Fucking crew.
Yeah. So special effects have changed a little bit. Because this was, yeah, this was a practical shot.
I like the miniatures that they did,
I
too.
I don't. Yeah. Yeah, they did miniatures. Because, I mean, this was filming up until the 90s, really. Where you didn't have the computer animation. You didn't have...
Hey, we have to show a boat going over a waterfall, but we can't actually do that in real life because it's dangerous and expensive. So let's...
Right. Although, Alec Guinness almost died in this film. The Admiral drowning. So they... To keep him on the boat and upright, they put a... basically, they tied a pole to the boat and to him. And as the boat went down a lot faster than they anticipated, so they were expecting to get let's say 30 seconds of the boat going down, but it only took 10 seconds. So then someone had to jump in and save Alec Guinness.
Was it a young, not yet born Mark Hamill?
maybe I think so. Or that's a you know Han Solo.
Makes
that's
sense.
How they met. Yeah, yeah. I mean, this film, you know, and going into it, I had not seen this film, but going into it, definitely the Alec Guinness role was the one that I was most curious about because, I haven't seen Alec Guinness in a lot of film besides Star Wars. I would like to think, you know, and to say generally that probably most people my age and younger, that's probably true, and even a little bit older. Right? I mean, I know he was a very prolific actor. He was well-known. He was the one name in Star Wars that was bankable because everybody else was unknown at the time. So seeing him in this it was really neat, especially him taking on all those other roles and doing it in, you know, and he wasn't... okay, so this is a bad comparison, but it gets to the point. Like, when you watch Big Mama's House, you know Martin Lawrence. You know Martin Lawrence, right? Because it's still Martin Lawrence there. It's more like, I would say it's more like how Eddie Murphy in Coming to America, like, where he became those other roles, and you didn't. You know, you wouldn't necessarily know that was Eddie Murphy in those other roles. You know, so I would compare it to that. Yeah, I would compare it to more of the Eddie Murphy in Coming to America or some of the other films that he did. Not the clumps. But I would say Coming to America, like in the barbershop and the church service and all that. But yeah, I was impressed by the filming techniques. This is still a black and white film.
It's technically a comedy, but it was shot dramatically, and like the DP
was
on point.
Yeah.
The way they planned everything out, you know, the scene where Alec Guinness is playing the, and the only reason why I thought of this because I just watched Bad Times at the El Royale the other night, so. A lot of good depth of field shots like this, but the shot where the father is going to grab cigars for him and Louis, he thinks he's a pastor, a priest from a different congregation. Louis slips in poison into the bottle of the wine because the father has a drinking problem. And he goes to grab those cigars, and it's a lot of wonders. Like, he walks back, he's out of focus, you see Louis poison into the wine bottle, and he closes it just as the father's coming back. And just moments like that, you don't, especially in comedies, you don't see dynamic shots like that. There's always exceptions to the rule, like Simon Pegg and all those guys. They do comedies, but they shoot it in the style of the movie that they're parodying.
Yeah, like Shaun of the Dead is shot like
Hot Fuzz is shot like a Michael Bay movie. But it's in the same vein. Like, and John Klein will argue this to death, but he claims that every comedy is shot flat, which I don't agree with. But in this case, like, it definitely had a dynamic look to it. Yeah, it's in black and white, and yeah, it's 4:3. So it's been a long time since I watched. Oh wait, I think that stupid French film we watched was 4:3. Anyways, everything was on point. The writing was good. Like, the jokes aren't ha ha jokes. Like, they're very highbrow aristocrat.
It's a dark comedy too, so it's
in a dark comedy.
Right, to me, the one of the first dark comedies that had a really big impression on me.
I was just gonna say that.
And you watch that film, and it's not ha ha laugh. It's okay, that was funny, but it's a dark comedy because it's you know, you're dealing with murder, you're dealing with. This film is basically just murder and being deceitful and all that, but it's humorous. I mean, just the when he's pulling the bow and arrow out to shoot down the balloon and the angle that he takes and all that to shoot the arrow, it's funny, and you find yourself being a little guilty laughing at
Definitely. They set it up, though. Like, these people aren't... Nobody in this movie's really good. Like, even Edith. In the beginning, when he met Louis, she's against drinking. She prohibits it, but she also thinks that she shouldn't push that on others. So she's a little, like, self-righteous. But really, everybody in this film is... they're not bad, but they're not, like... objectively good people. But Louis, no. I think Louis makes up for it because he's smart, intuitive, and he's charming.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, he learned to be an aristocrat from his mom, so he's definitely in the family. So a film that I can say that we both enjoyed. That what is interesting is there were two attempts so far.
I was trying to look this up. It doesn't look like it's been remade yet. I can't believe it hasn't.
Nope. So in 84, Ivan Reitman tried to remake it. With Dustin Hoffman. So Dustin Hoffman was big in the 80s. I think Dustin Hoffman probably would have been. I think the Alec Guinness role is the role that people want in this, right? Like, that's the role. So then it tried to. It was in 2000. There was another attempt to remake it. Mike Nichols tried to remake it. Mike Nichols. I'm trying to find out what he. So he directed The Graduate, Closer. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Angels in America. So he's, I think he'd be a good director for this. But he wanted to direct it with Robin Williams in the Alec Guinness role and Will Smith playing the Louis role. Which would have been an interesting pairing. Because 2000, Will Smith had some.
He was 50-50 at his prime. Like, he'd do something either really awesome or something really lame, in my opinion. But he was untouchable.
Well, I'm trying to. Yeah, I mean, in the 2000 is so that you know, so Men in Black is already out. Wild Wild West was out. So he was the big summer star, though. Like every summer he had a big film. So he would have been a big name. Obviously Robin Williams playing, and I think we would have gotten a very different. I think it would have been a goofier comedy. Because I think, I mean, just, you know, because I think Robin Williams, while he can, you know, and did play some very dramatic roles and did it very well, I think that having the chance to do 9 different characters would allow him to be goofy with some of those characters and to be more straight edge with some. So I think it would have been a very interesting film. I'd be much more interested in seeing that one than the Dustin Hoffman version, although Ivan Reitman directing it was very interesting.
Look, all I'm saying is the N-word is said 3 times at the end, and it completely took me by surprise.
Yes, me too. It's 1949, and I don't believe it was meant in the same
context. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Fill in the blanks if you know where I'm going with this.
Yeah, I always
thought we were taught
Tiger,
it was Tiger,
but
because it was the 80s.
Apparently it's not.
We didn't grow up in the South.
It's not Tiger. Or in Britain in the 1800s, for that matter. But yeah, I was completely surprised by that too, and
I chastised the film.
That was,
I was like, "Hey, oh, whoa! Like, what? Bada bing! Like, what's going on?"
So I doubt that part would have been in.
What? That's not going to make the remake. What if Will Smith's in it?
That's true. So this is a film, it sounds like we both would recommend. There's some very interesting cinematography work here back when cinematographers had to do a lot more. I think, I may get yelled at by cinematographers, but I think all the planning, all the work, all the setup and everything that the cinematographer had to do for that one shot that took 2 days.
Put it this way.
Versus, you know.
Obviously being a filmmaker now is different than being a filmmaker back then. But I think we can appreciate now the amount of time and the reason why we spend so much time pre-planning for stuff, even when it's like special effects nowadays, is because of all those people who, you know, blazed the trail before us and figured out, hey, you just can't just take a camera with a guy and shoot a thing and expect it to be good. Like, you have to plan. This is film.
Right.
It's not cheap.
Yep.
If you over or underexpose, we're fucked. Like, it's not video. And yeah, to a certain degree,
digital.
Yeah, we have a little bit easier
it's
nowadays. But
it's
also,
not, yeah.
I think we've made it more complicated because before you could just capture the image and that's what you would get, however you manipulated it. Now you have to hire 1,000 people from Taiwan or South Korea to design shadow, color, like, you know, add in edges. Like, there's so many things that have to be done to make a special effects shot work that I could argue it's just as hard, if not harder, than what it used to be.
It's in many ways you shifted the a lot of the work. Is that fair to say? Like, you shifted it from pre-production and production. You shifted a lot of that to post-production.
Well, a lot of that still falls. It shifts to different crews.
I mean,
like,
there still is work. You still need to get everything right. You still need to get the lighting right. You still need to
and
get
even the,
you know,
the DP still isn't the guy that ever moves the camera. Like, there's always a camera operator. So in this instance, we took the DP and instead of moving we moved them from a physical space into a digital one with certain things that we do now. Whatever I'm rambling about,
good.
I agree with you. It was totally hard doing that type of special effects, visual effects shot back in the day.
I think, too, like one thing that I think we both appreciate, and we're going to get soon into some older films, But a lot of this was either a first time or an early adaptation of these techniques that were groundbreaking at the time. These were, you know, now a lot of these shots are, you know, oh, yeah, we can do that. That's no problem. We'll just do it like this, 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 this. Back then, they had to figure out, no one's ever done this before. How are we going to do this? And it makes for a totally different dynamic when you're looking into it or thinking about it.
It just, it like reminds, just special effects in general just have, because what the Laurel and Hardy film we watched, I mean, that was what, 1920s? And they did a lot of visual.
Yeah, that was, Oh, 1932.
It felt like the 1920s. but, like, you know, you saw a lot of, like, early adaptations and, like, special effects shots there, and it's just cool to see the transition. I mean, film's always going to be turning into something different, but where we're at now, it's cool to kind of see where we came from, what people had to do to achieve that special look. And yeah, we can do it now with a computer, but it still takes, you know, somebody's hand to draw that, or it still takes somebody's, you know, color palette memorization to make the background look good. You know what I mean? It's morphed into something different, but I think different is good, and it's created a different eye or a different scope we can watch these stories through.
Yep, absolutely. So, just to kind of rewind and set as we're coming to the end, I think this is a film we would recommend. You can get it on Amazon
Prime. I rented it on YouTube for $2.
Yeah, so it is a film worth watching because it's an interesting story, and frankly, I would not be shy. I mean, I think the premise of the story has been done again, but I think this story being redone is something that will happen within the next
I would agree with you. There's no way it wouldn't. Like, this is a good movie. This is a good concept, and if we're gonna have three different Spider-Mans in 15 years, at least give me an updated Kind Hearts and Coronets.
I mean, you find an actor that wants to, you know, an ambitious enough actor that wants to play those roles. So like a Jack.
You know what?
Says,
you know what? This is what you do. Netflix, you're buying everything still. Buy the rights to this. Make it a miniseries. Boom, money.
Done. Okay, so our next film, we get to go to Italy. A Fellini film. Federico Fellini.
He is
a very famous director. He directed a lot of comedies that came out of Italy. He's a very, very well known director as well. He did I think he did La Dolce Vita.
Oh yeah, who could forget?
These are films that dominate. So 8.5, he was the writer for and director of. My wife, who studied Italian in college and also lived in Italy for a while.
Sorry, I'm being a dick. Go ahead.
My wife. That's her name. She's very familiar with Fellini. I think it's he's somebody that in Italy and Italian circles is looked at as being a major name in film history. So we get to see Armor Cord.
It's a movie about a tank.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. Cord. Whatever. I don't know. I'm always excited to watch the next movie because there's really only been one or two movies that I really just was like, eh. Otherwise, I've found something to like in almost everything we've watched. So I'll watch your stupid Italian movie.
Hey, it's not mine. This is the BBC that did this list. Remember, they're at fault. But this film is from 1973. So again, it is one that's older than what? Either of us. Yeah. Yeah, so that is our next film. Any last thoughts, Chad, about Kind Hearts and Cornets?
I'm
going to
point a laser at the camera. Because it looks like a green lightsaber that Luke would have, and Alec Guinness was in Star Wars.
Well, that's good. I needed some work in my eyes anyway, so thank you.
Oh, boy.
You know what else, Chad?
I was a working man.
Lord loves a working man.
Don't trust Whitey.
Don't trust Whitey.
And get rid of it.
See a doctor and get rid of it. And revenge is a dish when served. I don't know the rest of it.
Lukewarm, because it's Alec Guinness. Lukewarm. It's lukewarm. Ha ha.
Yes.
Ha
ha. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. If you want to follow along with us, again, you can follow us on, we're on the Facebook and the Twitter. You can also watch Armor Cord with us.
Yeah,
and
tell
us
if you hate us, too, because I'm always looking for constructive feedback.
I'd rather get people that love us. So if you hate us, it's at L Punisher. And if you love us,
at
Badger Colfax. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. Till next time.
The Filmological Society is a production of Redacted Media in association with Ghost Hat Media. For more information, find us on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, or visit us at www.ghosthat.net.